From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
My name is Mumia Abu-Jamal. I'm a journalist, a husband, a father, a grandfather, and an African-American. I live in the fastest-growing public housing tract in America.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, on this last day of African-American History Month, and Barbara Ehrenreich, on George Bush's congressional address. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. China reacted yesterday to U.S. criticisms of its human rights record by issuing a report of its own that condemned the United States as a land where money rules while children starve. In a lengthy report, the Chinese cabinet's information office dismissed American democracy as, quote, a game for the rich that had grown so corrupt few Americans even bothered to vote anymore. The report continued, while the United States likes to hold itself out as a, quote, model of democracy, the 2000 presidential election debacle further exposed the inherent flaws in the American electoral system. And the report also said that 13 million U.S. children live in poverty, 5,000 are killed every year by guns, and more than a quarter million work in factories and farms exposed to injury and poisonous pesticides. This news from Mexico. Zapatista commanders called for a full role for Indians in a different Mexico as enthusiastic crowds greeted them yesterday during the rebels' cross-country march for Indian rights. More than 5,000 supporters of the Zapatista National Liberation Army hung banners and cheered as the rebel leaders appeared before the cathedral in Orizaba, about 120 miles southeast of their destination, Mexico City. Comandante Ismael, one of the 24 Zapatista leaders on the march, said, "We want to fight for a different Mexico with room for all of us." He's one of the 24 Zapatista leaders making the 15-day journey. He said it's a disgrace for the country that's only now recognizing the rights of the Indians. We're joined on the telephone right now by John Ross. He's a journalist based in Mexico City and author of The War Against Oblivion, Zapatista Chronicles 1994 to 2000. John, I understand it is a circus along the route with more than 100 or hundreds of journalists along the way of the Zapatista March from Chiapas to Mexico City. And yet here in the United States, it's not getting much coverage at all.
Well, actually, I think it's gotten some coverage. Times picked it up. It's been on the pages of U.S. newspapers. But the truth is that it's taken a while to recapture the imagination of journalists based here. This conflict's gone on for 7 years, and for a long time it's been on the back burner. Just 100 days ago, people were wondering if the Zapatistas still existed. They hadn't communicated with their government for 5 months. So I think U.S. journalists, the correspondents here, are a little slow to wake up, and those that have been here for a long time, I think kind of take it with a grain of salt, saying that, well, it's gone on for a long time. We're going to see some more. It's not the most important story from Mexico at this point.
John, we also have this report from Cancun. Injured protesters loaded into ambulances and tourists strolled past bloodstained streets in Cancun after police charged a group of anti-globalization demonstrators kicking and beating those they could catch. The melee, which left about 19 people injured, came yesterday after a three-hour standoff that blocked the peninsula's main highway and brought much of the resort's traffic to a halt. Hundreds of protesters had been holding 2 days of marches against the World Economic Forum's Mexico meeting, where business and political leaders gathered at an upscale hotel to discuss the country's economic future. Protesters were saying no to capitalism, for humanity, and against neoliberalism, and Fox Mexico isn't for sale, of course, referring to the new president. So this is going on in Cancun while the March of the Zapatistas is going on elsewhere.
Well, I think the contrast is pretty obvious. As the news brief indicated, the Zapatistas have been talking a lot about two Mexicos. Certainly are two Mexicos right there in Cancun. If you go to the glittering hotel zone at one end of town, starkly in stark contrast to the regions, the slum cities where the people that work in those hotels live without services from the city or any kind of amenities at all. It's really, I think, the most stark illustration of what globalization actually does to a third world country, Cancun itself. The demonstrations in Cancun were a kind of tune-up for Quebec City and on April 15th. Folks from the Porto Alegre Forum that was held parallel to the Davos Forum participated, a number of students from the General Strike Council in Mexico City. And in a real sense, this was a warm-up, we might say, for what we're going to see at the Summit of the Americas on the 15th of April in Quebec City.
John Ross, I want to thank you for being with us. Also, key leaders of a long, bitter strike at Mexico's major university were expelled yesterday, a move that could set the stage for angry new protests in Mexico City, where John Ross is. Again, John Ross, journalist based there in Mexico City and author of The War Against Oblivion, Zapatista Chronicles, 1994 to 2000.
My name is Mumia Abu-Jamal. I'm a journalist, a husband, a father, a grandfather, and an African-American. I live in the fastest-growing public housing tract in America. In 1981, I was a reporter for WUHY-FM and president of the Philadelphia Association of Black Journalists. Currently, I'm a writer and public radio commentator. I've been a resident on Pennsylvania's death row for more than 15 years. Tune in to hear my regular reports. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. On this, the last day of African American History Month, we look at the life of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Democracy Now! Is the first national program to broadcast his commentaries from death row. It was 4 years ago this month, and a minute before we were scheduled to go on air, 12 Pennsylvania stations, all run by Temple University in Philadelphia, pulled Democracy Now! Off the air, saying it was, quote, inappropriate to air Abu-Jamal's voice. In the first part of today's program, we're going to turn to Barbara Ehrenreich and Professor Gwendolyn Mink to talk about President Bush's congressional address last night. But first, we're going to bring you the latest commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal. Soon after the Prison Radio Project and Democracy Now! Undertook the commentary series years ago, Pennsylvania prison authorities banned video and audio taping and photographing of prisoners. Occasionally, afterwards, we were able to receive a call from Mumia Abu-Jamal on this program after he won a legal battle within the prison. They had first pulled the phone out of the wall when he was talking to us. But because of the ban on the videotaping, audio taping, and photographing of prisoners, we were able to get this commentary by telephone line. The sound quality of the lines to Mumia Abu-Jamal have become increasingly poor, so we ask you to listen carefully.
The former Minister of Information for the Black Panther Party, Eldridge Cleaver, once said, "Information is the raw material for new ideas. If you get misinformation, you get some pretty messed up ideas," unquote. With late night lock changes and a phalanx of security guards prowling the halls, the crew of WBAI-FM, the flagship station of the Pacifica Network, had begun. Popular veterans of the listener-supported station, like program manager Bernard White and WBAI union shop steward Sharon Harper, both producers of the morning wake-up call show, received letters of termination at their homes several hours before their shifts were to begin. WBAI General Manager Valerie Van Eisler, who, like White, was a 20-year vet of the station, was similarly fired by Pacifica, ostensibly for failing to accept a position at network headquarters in Washington, D.C. While these firings were attempts to remove and thereby install management personnel, it was also an opening salvo in a pitched battle designed to silence radical dissent and open the airwaves to the corporatization of WBAI. If you want WBAI to become a nice, sweet, safe alternative like NPR, then do nothing, for that will happen. If, however, you want to continue to hear about the struggles of the peoples of the world for liberty, for life, for dignity, as in East Timor, or the noble life and death struggle of the Zapatistas in the mountains of Mexico, or of cases like the slaughter of African immigrant Amadou Diallo, or of the continuing human rights violations occurring every day in the nation's burgeoning prison industrial complex, then you must fight for it, as you would fight for your very life, or anything dear to you. The great Frederick Douglass perhaps put it best when he said, quote, "Without struggle, there is no progress," unquote. If the various communities of New York and northern New Jersey don't struggle for their vision of WBAI-FM, it'll be gone. It's as simple as that. What's happening at BAI was attempted a year ago at KPFA-FM in San Francisco. The people of the Bay Area rallied in unprecedented strength, over 10,000 folks at one protest, and backed the Pacifica board down. Listeners to BAI must do no less. In theory, at least, the airwaves belong to the people. For the last 40 years, the staff and local management of WBAI have tried to make that theory an American reality. If you're thrilled by the no-holds-barred radio reporting of Democracy Now's Amy Goodman, who's constantly threatened and harassed by the Pacifica board for her radical reporting, then fight for her. For in fighting for her, you fight for the finest traditions of WBAI and against the corporationists who want to turn a national resource into just another commodity. To keep it raw, to keep it real, you've got to fight for it. For more information, you may contact Concerned Friends of WBAI at 800-825-0055 or 718-707-7189. They can also be reached over the Internet at www.savepacifica.net. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And you are listening to Democracy Now! We'll be talking about the life of Mumia Abu-Jamal, the first biography written about him called On a Move, in a little while. But first to President George Bush's congressional address last night. Bush must have thought that Americans were tucked into bed with a glass of warm milk when he delivered his speech to Congress last night, talking about his plan to cut taxes by $1.6 trillion. President Bush said, quote, "Some say my tax plan is too big. Others say it's too small. I respectfully disagree. This tax relief is just right." The fairy tale of the middle. Well, President Bush pledged to set the nation on a different path by slashing federal debt while increasing spending for popular programs such as education, environmental protection, and medical research. The first Republican president since Dwight D. Eisenhower to address a Republican-led Congress, Bush proposed a limited but active government, renewed his call to privatize portions of Social Security and restrain government spending, which would require cuts at several federal agencies, and end racial profiling. Democrats warned that Bush's $1.6 trillion 10-year tax cut plan would jeopardize key government programs and lead the nation toward another era of federal deficits. President Bush disagreed.
40 years ago, and then 20 years ago, two presidents, one Democrat, one Republican, John F. Kennedy and Ronald Reagan, advocated tax cuts to, in President Kennedy's words, get this country moving again. They knew then what we must do now. To create economic growth and opportunity, we must put money back into the hands of the people who buy goods and create jobs.
President Bush speaking last night to a joint session of Congress. We're joined on the telephone right now by Gwendolyn Mink, professor of politics at University of California, Santa Cruz, and author of Welfare's End, and Barbara Ehrenreich, a well-known columnist for The Progressive magazine and other publications, and author of the upcoming book, Nickel and Dimes on Not Getting By in America. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Barbara Ehrenreich, your response to President Bush's address.
Can I just say one other thing, Amy, first? I really wanted to endorse what Mumia just said and say personally how grateful I am that we still have this space in which to talk, that is not dominated by Republicans or Democrats or big money. And please keep it up, Amy. I'm with you.
Thanks.
So I know I was probably not supposed to say that, but now going on to the Bush tax cuts, I want to say first that I am very, very disappointed by the Democratic response. I mean, the Democratic response is to say, essentially, this isn't fair enough or it's too big, both of which, you know, certainly the unfairness is extremely clear, but that nobody is saying from the Democratic side, look, there are things we need to do with public money that are not being done now, like no universal health care program, no universal child care program, you know, so many things, housing subsidies that need to be restored, that we desperately need to do, and that's what we should be doing with public wealth instead of turning it back to the richest people in America.
Gwendolyn Mink, your first reaction to the president's 49-minute address, again, proposing over 10 years, I believe, $2 trillion, roughly that.
Well, a tax cut. Much of what he said was anticipated. We've been prepared to hear these sorts of platitudes about how the people who make the most money deserve the most money back in tax relief over the past month or so. So I was disappointed by the lack of detail, really, in much of what he had to say. And like Barbara, was disappointed in the Democratic response for the reasons that she articulated, but also because although there was little in the way of detail in the president's address, what was very clear in what he did say and what has been said over the course of the past month is that a very profound change in the concept of national government is underway. And unless we confront that head on, we're going to be, 4 years out in a pretty desperate situation with respect to poor people and the rights of people of color and women of all races.
Well, let's talk about that, because this is 2001. The welfare reform bill passed by Congress, endorsed, pushed forward by President Clinton, happened in 1996. We're at the five-year point where how many people have to come off welfare?
Well, it's going to vary by state and by the point at which people enter the rolls. I understand in New York City there will be 70 or 80,000 people kicked off the rolls at the end of this year. The federal time limit was 5 years, 60 months, but some states' time limits are even shorter because the federal legislation permits that. So in some cases, people have been kicked off the rolls already. In 2002, the whole sort of structure of this new welfare policy will come up for review because it has to be refunded, and that proposes an opportunity to discuss many of the failings and inequities of the current law. As the current president and the current majority in Congress would have it, however, they are planning to have much more stringent additions to the welfare law to make things even more difficult for poor people.
Barbara Ehrenreich, one of the things that President Bush insists is that he won't raid the Social Security surplus, but he hasn't made the same promise for Medicare.
No, I wanted to add something else, though, to this discussion about welfare reform, What people are being kicked off welfare into is really an untenable situation, and that is jobs paying $6 to $8 an hour. Now, those are entry-level wages in the United States today. This tax cut that Bush is talking about, for people in the bottom 60% of the income distribution, which is, the great majority, the average amount they're going to get back is $227 each. Now, he's been exaggerating with those $1,600 checks and so on. Not that that's even so much if you have health insurance, if you have, child care costs and everything. But we're talking about $227 each to people who are not making it on their earnings, although they're trying very hard. So I think this is, this is a vast upward redistribution of wealth with no help for the people at the bottom who really need things like, and not just people at the bottom need these things like national health insurance, things like some kind of guaranteed child care, which will be provided by everybody through public subsidies.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, I want to address not just the Democratic response, but this other bloc in America, which is this the growing coalition of grassroots movements and where they stand in this new administration. We're talking to Barbara Ehrenreich, well-known columnist and author, and Gwendolyn Menk, professor of politics at University of California, Santa Cruz. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to take a look at President Bush's congressional address last night, we're joined by Gwendolyn Menk, professor of politics, University of California, Santa Cruz, and Barbara Ehrenreich, well-known columnist and author. Her upcoming book, Nickel and Dimes, A Not Getting By in America. Barbara Ehrenreich, the issue of the Democratic response, George Bush, to gain some kind of legitimacy with a presidency he was not elected to, has been stressing bipartisanship. But he can only do that really with the consent of the Democrats.
Yes. And they've been, I think, a little bit too eager to go along with it. I don't think they've drawn a clear line here. I don't think they're making strong points about this. I think simply saying this tax cut is unfair is so weak in the face of how grossly unfair it is. May I just mention one other little number here? The Citizens for Tax Justice, for example, estimates that George and Laura Bush themselves will get a windfall of $100,000 from this tax cut plan. That's contrasted to the $227 average I said the people in the bottom 60% of the income distribution will get. I mean, I think this is a total outrage, and the Democrats have shown themselves, as usual, to be spineless, and spineless in the face of an unelected president.
If you were to divide the $1.6 trillion tax cut by a family of four, each family would get something like $13,800. But that's clearly not going to be what it is, Gwendolyn Menk. In the kind of tax cut that we're talking about, what would we see?
Well, it's upwardly redistributive, as Barbara has just said, so that the folks at the top of the income bracket are going to get the largest dollar amount of relief because their tax brackets are going to be reduced. And that has a sort of gross effect in exacerbating income inequality in the United States. And it does certainly, of course, nothing to improve the general resources and stability of resources in this country to do the very constructive things that we need to do, such as shoring up Social Security, such as developing a universal health care program, such as trying to reconceive the ways in which we as a society can provide an income for everyone, including people who don't participate in the labor market but whose work is productive and essential for our society, such as the work of caregiving in families.
At this time of a massive surplus that President Bush is talking about, you have governors, Republican governors, going into emergency budgets, state budgets, to deal with very serious shortfalls in their states. How can that be, Barbara Ehrenreich?
Poor planning, I guess. I mean, there's one of the things that has been happening as a result of welfare reform, and I don't know if this is the complete answer to what you're talking about, is a huge new need for food stamps on the part of people, which many states just try to deny. If you're off of welfare, they'll illegally put you off of food stamps. But there's a lot of unmet need. I mean, we see it in maxed out food pantries. We see it in
a tremendous surge in homelessness.
Yes, we see it in homeless shelters turning people away. So we're mostly talking, as I think Gwendolyn said, about employed people. We're talking about people who someone in the family has a job, and yet they cannot make it on those wages. And that should be what this budget is about. That should be, you know, the number one concern is that we have something like 30% of the workforce in this country working full-time and not getting above a poverty-level wage. What do we do about that? How do we meet that need? But, of course, neither side, as I said, not even the Democrats, will bring that up.
And do you think that the grassroots organizations that are forming coalitions around the issue of globalization and the prison industrial complex, around the issue of police brutality, are they going to raise these issues?
Well, I'd like to hear what Gwendolyn thinks on this, too, but yes, I mean, I think that that's part of it, because this growing inequality in wealth is a worldwide phenomenon, and it's certainly driven to no small extent by transnational corporations that are based in the United States. But these are, of course, issues, the global inequality are things we can't address that easily just by looking at, say, George W. Bush or anything in Washington. These are things that ultimately are going to have to be addressed through transnational kinds of alliances between people, working people who are having an awfully hard time in the global economy.
I want to thank you both very much for being with us as we spend the next half of the program and this last day of African American History Month on Mumia Abu-Jamal, looking at his life and getting an update on his case. We've been speaking with Barbara Ehrenreich, columnist and author, Gwendolyn Menk, professor of politics at University of California, Santa Cruz. Thanks very much for being with us.
A lifetime may pass without an individual having been personally addressed by government. For millions, government is a remote venture, conducted by quasi-representatives in their name, with their silence oftentimes taken as acquiescence. Never is an individual as personally involved with government as when faced by the power of their freedom and very institution, and can therefore claim none of the rights and privileges which that instrument provides for and secures to citizens of the United States. On the contrary, they were, at that time, considered as a subordinate and inferior class of beings who had been subjugated by the dominant race, and whether emancipated or not, yet remained subject to their authority, and had no rights or privileges but such as those who held the power in the government might choose to grant them. They had, for more than a century before, been regarded as beings of an inferior order, and altogether unfit to associate with the white race, either in social or political relations, and so far inferior that they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect, and that the Negro might justly and lawfully be reduced to slavery for his benefit. Unquote. Dred Scott versus Sanford, U.S. Supreme Court. In these words, uttered by one of America's most brilliant jurists, the face of U.S. racist oppression was made plain. The plaintiff, the slave, Dred Scott, who sued for his freedom in U.S. courts and that of his wife, Harriet, and his daughters, Eliza and Lizzie, 14 and 7, respectively, found a court of law, but not of justice, which rejected his claim, saying, since he wasn't a citizen, the rights guaranteed in the Constitution, including the right to sue, didn't apply. 136 years after Scott, and still we find courts of law, but not of justice. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And you are listening to Democracy Now! Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal gathered last night at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture in Harlem to celebrate the publication of Abu-Jamal's first biography. It's written by Terry Bissan. Mumia Abu-Jamal began his journalism career with the Black Panther Party at age 15. He was Minister of Information for the Philadelphia chapter and wrote for the national newspaper. After the Panthers fell apart, Mumia turned to radio broadcasting. By age 25, he'd become one of the top names in local radio. Despite his success, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radicalism lost him jobs at black radio stations, and he was forced to moonlight to support his family. In 1978, at a press conference, the then Philadelphia mayor and ex-police chief, Frank Rizzo, threatened the, quote, new breed of radical journalists, those who dared to expose police misconduct. He said, the people believe what you write and what you say, and it's got to stop. His comments marked the beginning of a new campaign of police harassment. Then on the night of December 9th, 1981, Mumia Abu-Jamal was driving a cab and saw his brother being beaten by a police officer in the street. Abu-Jamal intervened. Both he and the police officer were shot. The police officer died. Several witnesses saw someone flee the scene. The police were never able to link Abu-Jamal's gun directly, which he was registered to carry during his late-night cab shifts, to the officer's wounds. However, Abu-Jamal was tried and sentenced to death. He was not allowed to defend himself in court because the judge, Albert Sabo, whom the Philadelphia Inquirer dubbed a defendant's nightmare, thought Abu-Jamal's dreadlocks would make jurors, quote, nervous. He's been on death row ever since. Now for two decades. Today, Terry Bissan joins us, author of the new biography of Mumia Abu-Jamal. It's called On a Move. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Well, thank you, Amy.
It's very good to have you with us. We also have on the line with us Marlene Kamish, who is an attorney and counsel for the Chicano Studies Foundation. And before we talk about Mumia's life, because I think that a lot of people don't really realize where he came from, we wanted to get an update on his case. Marlene Kamish, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much, and good morning, Terry and Amy.
Good morning. I'm familiar with your work through the writ, which I read, which I thought was very impressive.
Thank you very much, and I congratulate you on the wonderful book that you just have written and released.
Well, before we get to the writ, I wanted to just ask you about where the case stands right now. It's been moved to federal court, is that right?
The case has been pending in, Mumia's case has been pending in federal court since October 15th of 1999, and before Judge John, United States District Court.
And what has the judge said in this long period of time that it's been in federal court?
Well, there's been no hearing as of yet. And the important thing for your listening audience to understand is that this is the last opportunity that Mumia has as a right under the law in a court. If this court denies Mumia's petition, habeas petition, there is no court that has to hear an appeal under the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which this habeas is filed under. If the court denies Mumia's petition and denies his request for relief, refuses to recognize the constitutional violations in his case. If that should happen, then in order to have that court that decision reviewed and relief granted, the United States District Court Judge Yan would have to grant a certificate of appealability, and in order for it to go to a higher court. If the judge refuses to do that, Mumia could petition the Third Circuit for hearing, but the Third Circuit, similarly, is not required under the law to hear it.
Very briefly, the amicus brief that you have filed in June, can you tell us what it is?
Well, the amicus brief that we filed and which was denied leave was denied leave by the district court, so that the evidence now is excluded by the court, raised several structural issues in the trial which would have required an automatic reversal of Mumia's case. One of the primary issues raised in the amicus brief was the denial of the right of self-representation, the denial of the assistance of John Africa. The briefs raised for the first time the connivance on the part of the court-appointed attorney, Anthony Jackson, with Prosecutor McGill and the judge to deny Mumia his right of self-representation and to insulate his case from appeal.
Well, Marlene Kamish, I want to thank you for the update. Today we want to focus more on Mumia Abu-Jamal's life, how he came to where he is today. Any last comment?
Yes. Mumia Abu-Jamal is an innocent man incarcerated wrongly for 20 years. And in our briefs, in our request to the Third Circuit to order the court to accept the amicus brief, we call for his immediate discharge.
Marlene Kamish, attorney, counsel for the Chicano Studies Foundation, working on Mumia Abu-Jamal's case. He is at SCI Green in Pennsylvania, has been on death row for close to 20 years now. And Terry Bisson in the studio with us, who has written the first biography of Abu-Jamal, On a Move, the story of Mumia Abu-Jamal. How he came to be where he is. Actually, you have spent time with him as you wrote his biography. What is it like to go to the prison? Can you describe it?
Well, the prison is one of these sensory deprivation prisons that they have a lot of in the U.S. right now. Mumia is held in basically solitary confinement, and the prison is a hell. It's sterile, it's quiet, it's noiseless. You never see another person. He spends his life locked down. Hard.
When you walk in, what happens?
Well, you walk in through doors that open automatically. You pass papers to guards through little holes, sort of like going to the post office, except you can't quite see all the way through the glass. And everybody is isolated. The guards are isolated from the prisoners. The prisoners are isolated from each other. The visitors are isolated from the prisoners. No one ever talks directly or has any contact. This has been Mumia's situation for 20 years. It's also the situation of about 50,000 other prisoners in the U.S. and every state in the Union in these prisons, which are modeled on the West German sensory deprivation system.
You wrote this biography to tell his story. Where was Mumia born?
Mumia is from Philadelphia. I wrote the book because about a year ago it was decided by him and his agent, his publisher, and his supporters that we needed to get past the sort of the international celebrity, the death row, the anti-death penalty advocate, and sort of present where he came from. And he was, as he puts it himself, his life is not that different from a lot of other kids who grew up in the late 60s, early 70s. He's from the PJs, the projects in North Philly. He went to high school in Philly, got recruited into the Black Panther Party, was actually working as the Minister of Information for the Panthers and writing for the newspaper when he was 15 years old. And I think this is what really transformed his life. He was always a very precocious, very outgoing, very curious kid. But the Panthers gave him a venue at a very early age. And he flew out to Oakland when he was like 15, and he was writing for the newspaper out there. And he kind of never looked back. After that, he went to college for a while and got into radio. And
he was beaten up by police early in his life.
Yes, he once when he attended when he was in high school, and he went to a George Wallace rally. George
1968.
68. Wallace was running for president, and Mumia and recruited three friends to go with him to the stadium, and then they were chased by a mob, and they ran and they were caught, and they were beaten by the mob, and then by the cops, and then arrested.
In fact, they called the cops, right?
Yeah.
For help.
Yeah, and the cops helped, as they always do in Philadelphia. They helped the mob.
We're talking to Terry Bisson. He is author of On a Move, the first biography of Mumia Abu-Jamal. We'll be back with him and some commentaries of Abu-Jamal in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest is Terry Bisson. On a Move, the story of Mumia Abu-Jamal is the first biography of Mumia Abu-Jamal with a foreword by Chuck D. How old is Mumia Abu-Jamal right now?
Lord, I don't know. 54? Do the math.
Born in?
54.
Not born in 1954.
He's younger than me.
47 years
old.
Yeah,
he's about 47.
Mm-hmm. So he was beaten up by police. He was in the Black Panthers. The Black Panthers had a split between Cleaver and Newton. And what did he go on to do then in the 1970s?
Well,
I know he dealt with Attica and the uprising there.
Well, they dealt with that when he was in the Panthers. He sort of worked with the Panthers doing propaganda work, and then he went back to Philly, and he kind of floated around and had a couple of kids, and then he ended up going to college up in Vermont for a little while, to Goddard College, which is sort of an experimental, considered sort of a hippie school in those days. And then
we're broadcast on the Goddard College community station.
Well, then he came back from Goddard, and he would go back and forth, and then he worked in radio. The point, it is true that he got beaten up by the police when he was, I think he was only 14 then, and it's true that he was in a lot of confrontational stuff with the Panthers. But one of the ideas of this book, and one of the things that Mumia wanted to get in this book, was that he's not, get away from this idea that he's a victim, that he's a martyr, that he was somebody who was always in this contentious relationship with the world. He says, Mumia said, one of the things he wanted to get across was that being a revolutionary is fun. He said, I had a lot of fun. He said, hell, can you believe it? I'm still having fun. This is what he said to me on death row. And one of the things we try to get in this book is that his whole life has been his involvement in politics and radio and the media was brought a lot of joy to him. It has been a lot of fun for him.
And in fact, the radio station WRTI, that's run by Temple University, that pulled us from the airwaves when we started airing Mumia Abu-Jamal's commentaries, he was a broadcaster on.
Oh yeah, yeah. According to him, a lot of the Philly talk radio guys sort of learned their chops at WRTI. And Mumia worked on a lot of different venues. He would have a very straight job at a top 40 station at the same time, under another name, be doing an underground black culture show. He'd do all this stuff. He'd kind of juggle it. He'd do like four or five shows at once. He was he he was very serious about radio, and he worked very hard at it.
I believe it was Bill Simmering, who is one of the founders of All Things Considered, the beginnings of NPR national programming, who's based in Philadelphia, who said that Mumia Abu-Jamal was one of the most promising journalists at the time and thought he would move on to be a major figure in journalism.
Well, that's what they all thought. That was the general idea in Philly. And when the thing went down in December of 81, when the cop was killed and Mumia was injured, the whole city was shocked. And Mumia was very well known, and all the headlines at that time said, the prominent journalist involved in shooting and stuff. So he was very well known in Philly and was... He was considered by some to be on his way to a national reputation as a broadcaster. But there was a problem with that, because Mumia was always, he had the same conflict that a lot of journalists have, that I see in your own work, but between being a partisan and an objective reporter. And he was always struggling with that. And it was, he was always drawn towards a revolutionary partisan position. He always took sides. And this makes it kind of hard to get a national position, as you know.
We're talking to Terry Bisson. On a Move, the story of Mumia Abu-Jamal is his book. You talked about Mumia Abu-Jamal in prison now. What is his relationship like with the guards?
I don't really know. I mean, his relationship with everybody. Mumia relates to everybody in a very human way, and he can see even the guards, but I couldn't give you much scripture on that.
So you have him being in high school. He also in high school led moves to have the name changed of his high school.
Yeah, they wanted to change it. It was called it was Ben Franklin High School, and they wanted to change it to Malcolm X High School. And he also had a contradictory relationship in high school. He was a favorite of the teachers, the professors, the principals, all these kind of people. At the same time, at a certain point, they threw him out because he was making too much trouble. Because he was always agitating. He was always a little ahead of his class, and he was agitating to change the name of the school and do this and that and the other. And he was an activist at a very early age.
And he was being watched by J. Edgar Hoover. Can you talk about the FBI?
Well, the FBI file. Which they got through the Freedom of Information Act goes back to 69, I think, when Mumia was just, when he was 14 or 15. And they started to file on him because he was one of the seven or eight guys in Philly who started a branch of the party. And so he was active at the very start. And this is with a bunch of guys who were like 25, most of them were like 25 years old. But Mumia was big for his age. He was very articulate, and he took a leadership position. And they opened a file on him, as they did on many other people in those days, particularly in the Panthers.
And what are the files? What do they say? You have a few.
Right. Generally not much. They just say he went here, he went there. Mumia was a journalist. He was never a... they didn't really have very much on him. They would just kind of follow him around, and he basically would go here and there and do... he wrote a lot of... newspaper stories, you know. So the file doesn't tell you much except where he was and who he talked to on the phone and this and that and the other. But there wasn't a lot of exciting skullduggery going on out of the Philly branch. It wasn't a major center of power in the Panther Party. And Mumia's file is it's complete, but it's not the stuff of high adventure.
We're going to. Hear some of Mumia's commentaries to end this program and to end our programming on African American History Month. But Terry Bisson, what were you most surprised by? You knew Mumia Abu-Jamal before, and then you wrote his biography. What did you learn?
Well, what I learned, I guess, was I knew him as a radical. I'd met him through friends in prison. And what I learned from it was two things. One, I became convinced of his innocence. I had never really investigated the case or him, and I supported him regardless of whether or not he was guilty of the crime for which he was convicted. At this point, I support him even more because I'm convinced that he's innocent. And
did you have conversations with him about this?
Actually, we don't talk about that. Mumia has... He has a public position that he's innocent, but his legal position is that he wants a fair trial, and he believes he's entitled to it. So he doesn't. There are people he talks the case about, but we didn't talk about that in terms of the book. We, you know, he sort of reserves that for the trial. The other thing I learned was just about what it was, sort of what it was like to grow up. I'm a white guy from the South, so for me,
Kentucky.
Yeah. So for me. To learn about and to be have him give me the keys to go and talk to his family and his community and basically be accepted into the whole black culture in Philadelphia was a great privilege, and I learned a whole lot from that.
Well, Terry Bisson, I want to thank you for being with us. The book is On a Move: The Story of Mumia Abu-Jamal. It's published by Litmus Books. You're listening to Democracy Now.
In every phase and facet of national life, there is a war being waged on America's poor. In social policy, poor mothers are targeted for criminal sanctions for acts, if committed by mothers of higher economic class, would merit treatment at the Betty Ford Center. In youth policy, governments hasten to close schools while building boot camps and prisons as their graduate schools. Xenophobic politicians hoist campaigns through the dark star of imprisonment for street beggars, further fattening the fortress economy. The only apparent solution to the scourge of homelessness is to build more and more prisons. In America's 90s, to be poor is not so much socioeconomic status as it is a serious character flaw, a defect of the spirit. Federal statistics tell a tale of loss and want so dreadful that Dickens, of A Tale of Two Cities fame, would cringe. Consider 7 million people homeless with less than $200 in monthly income. 37 million people, 14.5% of the nation's population, living below poverty levels. Of that number, 29% are African Americans, meaning over 10.6 million blacks living in poverty. Both wings of the ruling Republican Party try to outdo themselves in announcing new, ever more draconian measures to restrict, redress, restrain, and to eliminate the poor. One is reminded of the wry observation of French writer Anatole France: the law, in its majestic equality, forbids the rich as well as the poor to sleep under bridges, to beg in the streets, and to steal bread. Already, U.S. manufacturers have fled to NAFTA-friendly Mexico, and only the Zapatista insurgency in Chiapas has slowed an emerging flood of Western capital. Outgunned in the industrial wars by Japan and Germany, the U.S. has embarked on a low-technology, low-skilled, high-employment scheme that exploits the poor, the stupid, and the slow via a boom in prison construction, America's sole growth industry. Increasingly, more and more Americans are guarding more and more American prisoners for more and more years, and this amidst the lowest crime rate in decades. No major political party has an answer to this social dilemma, short of cages and graves for the poor. The time is ripe for a new, brighter, life-affirming vision that liberates, not represses, the poor who, after all, are the vast majority of this earth's people. Neither serpentine politics nor a sterile economic theory which treats them, people, as mere economic units offer much hope, for the very politicians they vote for spit in their faces while economists write them off as non-persons. It must come from the poor, a rebellion of the spirit that reaffirms their intrinsic human worth based upon who they are rather than what they possess. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
This is Cornel West. Will we ever listen to and learn from our bloodstained prophet? After over 15 years of nightmarish jail conditions, Mumia Abu-Jamal's soul is not only intact but still flourishing, just as the nation's soul withers. As one who has lived on the night side of this dream, unjustly imprisoned for a crime he did not commit, Mumia Abu-Jamal speaks to us of the institutional injustice and spiritual impoverishment that permeates our culture. He reminds us of things most fellow citizens would rather deny, ignore, or evade.
American mass media is a marvel of technology. It is whiz-bang, sparkle, glitter, and satellite wizardry. It is a master plan of methods to communicate in a pauper's worth of substance. With such technology, how are people so woefully misinformed? The average American neither knows nor cares about the vast world beyond the nation's border. The average American student knows little math, no history, and very little geography, and nor does he or she want to know. Americans have computers in school, dozens of TV stations, and the most aggressive news media on earth. Does that mean they're better informed? Hardly. On November 2nd, 1995, the United Nations General Assembly voted overwhelmingly, 117-3, to condemn the United States for its continuing blockade of Cuba. The international community called the United States blockade a flagrant act of aggression and a blatant violation of international law. That the UN vote was reported at all in American media is amazing, for such news is more often than not passed over entirely by the American press. But where was information about the blockade itself, the effects suffered by the Cuban people, in-depth comments from United Nations delegates and leaders around the world? For a more substantive report, one had to listen to the BBC World News Service, for the rest of the world takes note of events the U.S. prefers to ignore. American media is a business, and it has a mission, not to inform Americans, but to entertain them. Every media enterprise in America reports the drivel that Marcia Clark and Chris Darden are secret lovebirds. But the vote of a global assembly condemning U.S. actions received only scant coverage at best. Why? The media is a source of titillation more than information. The mission of the media is to please, to comfort, and primarily to sell. When TV was developed, it was promised that every American would learn about the world in his living room. When computers were developed, wasn't it said that they would be invaluable learning tools and that children would learn more faster? National scholastic tests show otherwise, as kids master computers as toys and learn splendid hand-to-eye coordination, but little else. The media paints false pictures of the nation and the world, pictures designed to serve corporate masters and to make America look good. This feel-good media approach serves the American delusion of white supremacy, but it does not inform. When the New York Times echoes the National Star, what can the word media mean? How could millions be surprised at Minister Farrakhan's enormous influence among blacks unless the media wasn't doing its job? How could they look at a million and count less than half that number? The major media, like its racist projections, is to be rejected, not consumed, for your very patronage gives it life. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
I am Adrienne Rich. Waking to our alarm clocks and coffee, hurrying to work, later holding our children or making love, we, outside, aren't supposed to feel connected with people inside, least of all lifers and those on death row. Mumia Abu-Jamal's eloquent, scholarly, urgent dispatches teach us that we ignore those connections at our own peril.
Abu-Jamal here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Produced by Terry Allen and Chris Abrams. Errol Maitland, our technical director. Anthony Sloan, our engineer. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of you, our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to Democracy Now!